Chapter 10 Teddy Kang cracked his knuckles and rolled his shoulders. He didn't like sitting, and he'd been in the car for the best part of 2 hours.
"Are you okay?" asked the driver.
His name was Billy Huang, but he was known as Big Billy because he was huge, and not just for a Chinese. Huang was third-generation British Chinese, who'd benefited from a Western diet his whole life, coupled with a love of bodybuilding that had gripped him from his teenage years.
"What the hell is he doing in there?" asked Huang, gesturing at the pub across the road. "He's taking forever." "Drinking, probably," said Kang.
"It was a rhetorical question," said Huang. They spoke in English. Huang's Cantonese was rough at best, and his Mandarin was non-existent. He spoke English with an Essex accent, unlike Kang, who had a good grasp of the language, but sometimes had trouble making himself understood.
"So, why did you ask it?"
"Well, that's the point of a rhetorical question," said Huang. Kang didn't want to give Huang the satisfaction of admitting that he didn't know what rhetorical meant, so he stared out of the window and cracked his knuckles again. He was wearing tight-fitting black leather gloves and a black bomber jacket. The van they were sitting in had the name of a Chinese wholesale food company on the side. They had put down sheets of polythene in the back, because even though Kang was an expert with a knife, there was always some blood. Ian Johnston lived in a flat in a run-down part of Ealing, in a house which had once been home to one large family. In the 80s, it had been subdivided into one-bedroom and studio flats, with the garden paved over for parking spaces. The house was on a busy road, and Kang had realised that it wasn't a suitable place for what he needed to do. Kang had downloaded the man's picture off the newspaper's website. He had the picture on his lap. The pub was a short walk from Shepherd's Bush tube station, so Kang figured the man would take the train home. They'd watched the journalist go into the pub at 6 o'clock, and it was now almost 8. The door opened, and Kang stiffened, but then two women in short skirts and tight tops appeared, clearly the worse for wear.
"What if he doesn't come out?" asked Huang. "He has to leave at some point. It's a pub," said Kang. "What time do pubs close? 11?
"Sometimes later," said Huang. He looked at his watch. "My wife is cooking wonton soup tonight."
"It'll keep," said Kang.
"She won't be happy."
"She'll get over it," said Kang. "If we don't get this done, C.K. Lee isn't going to be happy. And when C.K. Lee isn't happy..."
He shrugged and left the sentence unfinished. He looked down at the picture. Johnston was in his 30s, balding with a comb-over and thick-lensed glasses. When Kang looked up, he saw the man himself standing on the pavement, wrapping a black-and-white scarf around his neck.
"That's him," said Kang.
Huang started the engine.
"Pull up alongside him after he turns into the next road. I'll get out and talk to him."
The journalist had started to walk away from the pub, swinging a battered leather briefcase as he walked.
"Get the side door open."
Huang did as he was told, indicating before he made the turn to follow the man down the quiet side street. He stopped, and Kang jumped out.
"Hey, mate, do you know where Seymour Road is?" asked Kang.
He looked left and right. There was no one else on the pavement, and the van shielded them from any passing traffic. Johnston stopped, frowning.
"Seymour Road? Yeah, it's near here somewhere." He reached into his pocket. I've got the address.
The side door grated open, and Johnston turned towards the sound. Kang pulled his flick knife from his pocket, pressed the steel button with his thumb, and felt the blade shoot out and click into place. He stepped forward, slapped his left hand over the man's mouth, and stabbed him half a dozen times in the kidney. Johnston struggled for a few seconds, but went limp as he bled out. Huang grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and pulled him into the van. Kang lifted the man's legs, rolled him over, and then slammed the door shut. It had taken less than 5 seconds. Kang retracted the blade of his knife, slipped it back into his pocket, and climbed into the passenger seat. Huang joined him.
"You've got blood on your hand," said Kang.
Huang held up his gloves and groaned when he saw the smear of blood across the knuckles of his left hand.
"Bastard was bleeding all over," he said, and wiped it on his seat. "What the fuck are you doing?" asked Kang.
"Wiping it off," said Huang.
"On the fucking seat? Are you retarded? Don't you watch television? CSI? Blood Trace?"
"Sorry," said Huang. "I'll clean everything later."
"Make sure you do," said Kang, folding his arms. "All they need is one drop, and they'll know everything. You've got to be careful. It's not like China, where no one gives a fuck if a journalist disappears. This is London, and someone will be looking for him."
Huang drove to a lock-up in Southall, the middle garage in a line of seven with identical green wooden doors. Huang stayed at the wheel while Kang got out and unlocked the up-and-over door and switched on the single light bulb that illuminated the interior. Huang reversed in. The lock-up was about 4 feet longer than the van, and up against the far wall were two oil barrels. Kang tapped on the side of the van once the nose was just inside, and he pulled down the door. Huang got out and opened the rear door of the van, while Kang took the top off of one of the barrels. Together they rolled the body out of the van and tipped it into the barrel. Next to the barrel were 21-gallon containers of hydrochloric acid drain cleaner. Hanging on a nail in the wall were two protective masks. Kang put one mask on and gave the other to Huang. Together, they emptied the containers of drain cleaner into the barrel. It took them the best part of 10 minutes. Then Kang replaced the lid and banged it into place.
"We're done," he said.
Lebrun's body was in the other barrel. The barrels would be left in the lockup for a week while the acid did its work. Then someone else would dispose of them. Huang got back into the van. Kang opened the door, switched off the light, and Huang drove out.
"Why did we kill him?" asked Huang, as Kang got back into the van.
"Does it matter?"
Huang shrugged his massive shoulders.
"Not really. So, it's a rhetorical question, right?"
Huang chuckled, but didn't reply. Chapter 11. Gabe was lying on his back, staring up at the ceiling. He was visualizing taking penalties. The goalkeeper was Ted Crowley, the man he'd be facing in just 15 hours' time. Gabe placed the ball, took 4 steps back, paused, then ran forward and kicked. The ball powered into the back of the net.
"You're not sleeping?" whispered Laura.
She was curled up with her back to him, her hair a jet-black curtain across her pillow.
"Sorry," he said. "You know you're kicking."
"Sorry, I'm taking penalties," she chuckled.
"Yes, I know. It's your thing."
"My thing?"
"Your thing. You keep running them through your mind, and when you kick, your right leg twitches. It's called visualization."
"I know what it's called, baby." She rolled over and draped her arm across his chest.
"Are you worried about tomorrow?"
"No more than usual," he said. "I'm just playing all the options. Where to place the ball, where to faint."
"You've done it 1,000 times, baby."
"I know. Like you said, it's my thing." She snuggled against him.
"You need your 8 hours, she said. "You know how grumpy you get if you don't get your 8 hours.
He looked over at the alarm clock on the bedside table. It was just before 1.
"It's early," he said. "I'll sleep soon."
Her fingers ran through the hairs on his chest and down his stomach.
"Would a blowjob help?"
He smiled. "That's your prescription?"
"I'm a doctor. You can trust me."
"I do, baby."
"So you'll take your medicine?"
Her hand found its way between his legs.
"I'd be crazy not to."
She moved down, and his hand stroked her soft hair as she went to work on him. Chapter 12. Gabe ate the same thing the morning of every match. Cocoa Puff cereal and 2 bananas. Laura called it the breakfast of champions. She had toast and marmalade. Ollie had 2 hard-boiled eggs. Kickoff was at 3, and Gabe was supposed to be at the ground by 10 for a warm-up and a pre-match briefing. After breakfast, Gabe took Ollie out for a kickabout in the back garden, another pre-match tradition. They kicked the ball back and forth,
Then Gabe watched as Ollie practiced juggling the ball with his feet and knees. He realized Laura was watching him from the kitchen window and he waved. She blew him a kiss back. Ollie wanted to be in goal and have Gabe kick penalties, but Gabe shook his head. "You can take the penalties, and I'll go in goal," he said. He knew it was crazy, but at the back of his mind was the conviction that if he failed to get a shot past his son, he'd repeat the failure on the pitch. Ollie beat Gabe with his first two shots, but Gabe managed to grab the third. Ollie was about to kick again when Laura appeared at the kitchen door, waving his mobile. "It's Joe," she shouted. Gabe jogged over to her and took the phone. "Hey, Joe, have you seen Eric?" asked McNamara. "Eric? No. Or heard from him? Joe, like I said before, we're not joined at the hip. I haven't seen him since training on Thursday, and he seemed fine then. What's wrong?" "He's still not answering his phone. I called him half a dozen times last night, and it keeps going straight through to voicemail. See him this morning. Gabe, just between the two of us, he's not going off the rails again, has he?" "I don't think so." "You don't think so?" Gabe sighed. "Joe, I'm not his best mate, not by a long way. If he started drinking and gambling and God knows what, I doubt he'd tell me. Look, I'm ready to leave. Why don't I swing by his place?" "You don't mind?" "No problem. I'll just leave a few minutes earlier. His place is on my way. I'll ring his bell, see if he's overslept." "Please, Gabe, and call me as soon as you find out what's going on." McNamara ended the call, and Gabe called over to Ollie. "I've got to go. I'll see you at the stadium, yeah?" Ollie and Laura would be watching from the family box with the rest of the team's families and friends. "See you, Dad," shouted Ollie. "Is there something wrong?" Laura asked as he went back into the kitchen. "Eric's gone walkabout by the sound of it." "Is he drinking again?" "I hope not, but he's not answering his phone." "He's got a self-destructive streak," said Laura. "He drove away his wife, lost his kids, lost his house. He's got an addictive personality, there's no doubt about that. And his addictions feed off each other. He drinks, then he gambles, then he loses, so he drinks even more." "Easy come, easy go," said Gabe. "The money means nothing to him. He doesn't seem to care whether he wins or loses when he gambles. If anything, he seems to want to lose." "That's what I mean. Self-destructive." "I told Joe I'd drop by, see if he's at home."
"Why you, baby?"
"It's on the way."
"He's not your responsibility," she laughed.
"Hell, he's the captain. He's supposed to be the responsible one." "It's no biggie," said Gabe. "I'll just knock on his door, see if he's home."
"Do you want me to come with you?"
Gabe shook his head. "I can handle it, baby. He's probably in bed with a hangover. I'll throw a bucket of water over him and drive him in." Laura kissed him on the cheek.
"I'd tell you to break a leg, but under the circumstances..."
He laughed, grabbed her and kissed her on the lips. 10 minutes later, he drove away from the house. He didn't notice the two vans parked at the side of the road. One had the name of a Chinese wholesale food company on the side. The other belonged to a cable TV company. Both drivers were Chinese, and both were wearing dark glasses. But Gabe didn't notice that either. Chapter 13. Laura was pouring orange juice for Ollie when the doorbell rang. She put down the carton and headed down the hallway. She opened the door and frowned when she saw the two men standing there. They were Chinese, both wearing blue overalls and one of them carrying a clipboard. The one with the clipboard blinked at her from behind wire-framed spectacles.
"Mrs. Savage?"
"Yes."
"You have a problem with your cable TV?"
"I don't think so."
He looked at the clipboard.
"Your husband phoned us. He said there was a problem with the sports subscription channels."
"He didn't mention it to me."
"It'll only take us a few minutes to check the signal."
"What company are you with?"
"Our company is Teleservice," he said. "We carry out technical repairs for most of the cable companies."
He tapped the logo on the breast pocket of his overalls.
"We're everywhere."
"Well, I don't think we have a problem, so thank you," said Laura, starting to close the door. The man without the clipboard put his foot inside the door.
"We should take a look, just to be sure," he said.
Laura looked down at his foot. His shoes were black and white with a buckle on them, not the sort of shoes you would expect a cable repairman to be wearing. She was still staring at the shoe when the man pushed the door hard. It banged against her head, and she staggered back. The two men rushed towards her. The one who'd pushed the door had something in his hand. At first, she thought it was a phone, but then he pressed a button, and blue sparks crackled between two metal prongs. "No!" she shouted, and flailed her arms, but the man pushed her in the chest, and she staggered backwards. She lost her balance, slipped and fell, banging her head on the wooden floor.
"Mummy!"
she heard Ollie shout, and she heard him run from the kitchen.
"Ollie, no!"
she shouted. But then the man was on top of her and had the stun gun against her neck. He pressed the button, and her body went into spasm, and then everything went black. Chapter 14. Gabe drove slowly through Wapping looking for the warehouse conversion where Eric LeBrun lived. LeBrun had been living in the Riverside apartment in Wapping for just over a year. He'd moved in not long after his divorce had been finalised. His wife had taken the house in Sussex, the cottage outside Nice, and the apartment in Paris with its view of the Eiffel Tower. LeBrun hadn't contested any of her demands, much to the chagrin of his lawyer. LeBrun never cared much for money or for possessions. All he'd really cared about was his children, and his wife had been happy enough for him to see them whenever he wanted. He'd rented a three-bedroom apartment so that his son and daughter could have their own rooms when they visited, and he'd stocked it with all the latest electronic gadgets to keep them amused. Gabe had only been once when LeBrun had thrown a moving-in party, and while the booze and models had flowed, LeBrun had been morose throughout. The apartment was on the top floor of a warehouse conversion, and there were double yellow lines along the street outside, but Gabe managed to find a parking space down a side road. He walked back to the entrance to the building. LeBrun lived on the top floor, and Gabe pushed the button on a stainless steel console to the left of the door. There was no answer, so he pushed again, and again. When there was still no answer, he walked along to the car park entrance, two massive wrought-iron gates with another keypad set into the wall. He peered through the gates, but couldn't see LeBrun's car, so he went back to the main entrance and tried the bell again.
"Can I help you?"
said a voice behind him, and Gabe turned to look at a blonde woman in her mid-30s, wearing a purple tracksuit and gleaming white trainers. She was jogging on the spot as she smiled at him, and Gabe couldn't help but notice how her breasts bobbed up and down.
"I'm looking for Eric. He lives on the top floor?"
She stopped jogging.
"He's not answering?"
"No, I can't get him on the phone either."
"You're a friend?"
Gabe nodded. "Sure."
"He was there yesterday. I heard him. His flat's above mine."
"Did you see him?"
She shook her head. "No, but I heard him banging around at about 9.
"At night?"
9 in the morning.
"Banging around, you said?"
She nodded. "Like furniture being moved, and the TV was on loud."
"What was he watching?"
"I don't know, but there was shouting."
She frowned quizzically.
"Oh, maybe it wasn't the TV. Is that what you mean? You think something happened?"
I don't know. Look, I know this is a lot to ask, but can we go downstairs and see if his car is there? I can't get into the car park."
"Sure, I can let you in."
She unzipped a waist pack and pulled out a small pink wallet, then went over to a square sensor set in the wall below the keypad. She pressed the wallet against it, and there was a loud click, and the gates began to open inwards. She followed him into the car park. There were a couple of dozen cars parked and as many empty bays. Each parking bay had the number of the flat it had been assigned to, painted in white on the tarmac, but Gabe didn't need the number to recognise LeBrun's car. Gabe pointed over at a gleaming red Porsche.
"That's his," said Gabe.
He pursed his lips and sighed.
"What's wrong?"
"If his car is here, where the hell is he?"
"He could have taken a taxi."
"Eric liked to drive." He nodded at the Porsche. "No point in having a Porsche if you don't show it off. That's what he always said."
"Do you think something's happened to him?"
"I hope not. But I'm starting to get a bad feeling about this."
"Have you spoken to Bill?"
"Bill?"
"Bill O'Hara. He lives in the flat opposite. He'll be home. Come on, I'll let you in."
The gates had closed behind them, so she had to touch another sensor in the wall to let them out.
"Oh, my God! You're Gabe Savage, aren't you?" she asked as the gates opened.
"That's me," she laughed.
"I'm sorry. I should have recognised you straight away. It's just you look different in a suit."
"The manager makes us wear them on match days," he said. "We get fined if we don't."
"Are you serious?"
"Says it builds team spirit." "He's probably right."
"Well, to be fair to him, you do look good in a suit."
She smiled and held out her hand.
"Lisa."
"Nice to meet you, Lisa," said Gabe. "Thanks for your help."
"My nephews will be made up when they hear I met you," she said. "They're huge fans." She grinned. "Listen to me babbling away," she said. "I'll let you in and you can go up and talk to Bill."
She tapped a 4-digit code into the keypad and pushed the door open. It led into a small reception area where there was an unmanned desk and a bank of mailboxes.
"There's no security guard or receptionist?" asked Gabe.
"There used to be, but there hasn't been for a few months," said Lisa.
She pointed to the left.
"The lifts are that way."
She headed for the mailboxes as Gabe went round the corner and took one of the 2 lifts up to the top floor. He rang the doorbell to LeBrun's flat and knocked on the door just to satisfy himself that there was no one at home, then rang the bell of the flat opposite. The door opened after a few seconds, and a bald man with a bushy beard peered out. He was in his late 40s and wearing a brightly coloured caftan. The sweet smell of marijuana oozed through the door, and by the glazed look on the man's face, he was clearly under the influence.
"Bill?" "You'd better not be trying to sell me something," said O'Hara.
He blinked, rubbed his eyes, then his jaw dropped as he looked again at Gabe.
"Fuck me. You're Gabe Savage."
Gabe grinned. "Guilty as charged."
"You're playing today, right?"
"Hopefully," said Gabe. He pointed at the door to LeBrun's flat.
"Have you seen Eric recently?"
"Sure. Yesterday."
"He was okay?"
O'Hara frowned.
"Sure. Is there a problem?"
"I'm not sure," said Gabe. "He missed training yesterday and he's not answering his phone, but his car is in the car park."
"He was fine yesterday. He was checking his mailbox."
"What time would that have been?"
9:30.
O'Hara grinned.
"He was wearing his dressing gown. Never was an early riser, Eric."
"Do you think he was hungover?" O'Hara grinned.
"Come on. You know Eric. He likes his drink."
He frowned.
"You think something's wrong?"
"I don't know," said Gabe. "But I'm wondering if I should call the police and get them to check the flat."
"No need," said O'Hara. "I've got a key. Eric and I swapped spare keys a few months back after he locked himself out one night."
"Do you mind?"
"Of course not."
O'Hara disappeared back into his apartment and reappeared 30 seconds later with a key on a chain with a plastic football. They crossed the corridor to LeBrun's flat and Gabe knocked on the door. When there was no response, he stepped to the side and let O'Hara unlock the door. O'Hara pushed the door open.
"Eric, are you there? It's Bill. Are you okay?"
When there was no reply, he pushed the door fully open and motioned for Gabe to go in first.
"Eric, are you there?"
shouted Gabe as he walked slowly along the hall. The 2 men walked into the main room with its spectacular views over the Thames. Gabe saw a half-empty bottle of brandy on the floor by the sofa, and he cursed under his breath. Then he saw the broken chair by the open-plan kitchen and a shattered coffee mug on the floor behind the front door.
"He's not here," said O'Hara, stating the obvious.
Gabe picked up the brandy bottle. LeBrun was a champagne drinker or vintage red wine. The spirits were usually for visitors. He put the bottle on a sideboard. The coffee had pooled on the varnished wood floor. Some had dried, which suggested it had been spilled hours earlier.
"That doesn't look good," said O'Hara, nodding at the broken coffee mug.
"You didn't hear anything?" asked Gabe.
O'Hara shook his head. "No, but I was out most of the day. I didn't get back until about 8.
"What do you think? He had an accident. Fell over."
"I don't know," said Gabe. "It's possible. Maybe. He might have fallen and gone to hospital. Maybe an ambulance came."
"Shit."
"Yeah, he might be fine. You can wait forever in A&E these days."
"So why isn't he answering his phone?" O'Hara looked around and then pointed at a sideboard.
"Because it's there,"
he said. There was an iPhone next to a bowl of fruit. Gabe went over and picked it up. There were several dozen missed calls, mainly from Joe McNamara, and as many text messages.
That doesn't make sense, said Gabe. Why didn't he take his phone with him?
Chapter 15. When Laura came to, she was lying on her side, and everything was dark. She blinked her eyes several times, and then realized there was something over her face. She tried to take off whatever it was, but she couldn't move her hands. They were bound behind her back.
Ollie, she shouted. Ollie, where are you?
Something clipped the side of her head.
Be quiet, snarled the man.
Where's my son? She asked. Where's Ollie?
He's here, he's fine. Now shut up.
I want to see my son.
There was no answer. She realized she was in a vehicle. She could hear the sound of traffic, and there was the vibration of an engine.
I demand that I see my son, she said.
There was a crackling sound, and something pressed against her neck, and her whole body went into spasm, and she passed out. When she awoke a second time, the vehicle had stopped moving, and she heard a door opening. Her head was throbbing, and she felt awful. Hands grabbed at her, at least four, and they pulled her out, and she was thrown over someone's shoulder. She tried to speak, but this time her mouth was so dry she couldn't do anything other than cough. She heard male voices, guttural and talking a language she didn't recognize. Then the crunch of feet on gravel, then the thud of feet on something harder. Her head banged against something, and then she could tell she was inside. She heard more voices, then she felt herself being carried up a flight of stairs. Then her head banged against a wall, and she was taken to the left. They stopped. She heard a door being opened, and she was carried again, and then suddenly she gasped as she was thrown through the air. She hit something soft. A bed, she realized.
Hello?
She croaked. There was no answer. She heard a thud on the other side of the room.
Is there someone there?
She said. She strained to listen. Whatever had been pulled over her head was muffling most of the sounds around her, but then she heard a door being closed.
Hello?
She said again. She tried to sit up, but with her hands tied behind her and her legs also bound, that was impossible. She lay back, gasping for breath, her face bathed in sweat.
Ollie, are you there? She said.
There was no answer, and she began to cry. Chapter 16. Gabe went back downstairs. Lisa was still in reception by the mailboxes, holding half a dozen letters and clearly waiting for him.
Any joy?
She asked. Gabe shook his head. He's not there. But it looks as if something happened.
Like what?
There's a broken chair. That might have been the noise you heard. Were you in all day yesterday?
Most of the time, yeah.
And no ambulance came. I would have said. Yeah, I know, I know. Sorry, it's just I can't work out why he would have left the flat without his phone.
Lisa grimaced. I wish I could help. I hope he's all right.
Gabe looked at his watch. I've got to go, he said.
Can I ask you a favour?
Sure.
Can I take a selfie with you? My nephews won't believe I actually met you if I don't show them a picture.
Gabe laughed.
Of course.
Brilliant,
she said. She stood close to him, held the phone out and pouted. Gabe couldn't help grinning. She took a picture, then another for luck, and then thanked him effusively. Gabe hurried outside to his car and climbed in. He drove off and slotted his iPhone into its holder on the dashboard before calling Joe McNamara on hands-free.
"Eric's not in his flat," said Gabe, "but his car is parked there. There's some damage in the flat as if he'd fallen over. A neighbour heard some noise yesterday morning."
"What do you mean, damage?"
"A broken table, smashed mug."
"You got into his flat?"
"A neighbour had a key. Oh, his phone was there."
"This is not good, Gabe. The only thing I can think of is that he had some sort of accident and is in hospital."
"I'll get someone to phone around," he said. "Look, Gabe, I hate to ask, but were there any signs that he'd been drinking?"
"No," said Gabe. "There was a cup of coffee spilled on the floor. No booze." Gabe thought it best not to mention the half-empty brandy bottle because he was fairly sure that LeBrun hadn't been drinking it.
"Well, that's something, I suppose. Where are you now?"
"Driving to the training ground. I should be there in about half an hour."
"See you there," said McNamara. "Look, if Eric is off the grid,
How'd you feel about taking over as captain for the match?
Oh, hell, Joe, I've got enough on my plate with the penalties.
Just for this game, Gabe, please. You'd be doing me a big favour.
OK, said Gabe.
You're a star, said the coach, and he ended the call. Gabe drove for 5 minutes, and then his phone rang again. He looked over at the screen. It was Laura, calling on FaceTime. He swiped the green phone with his finger and then concentrated on the road.
"Baby, I'm driving," he said.
"Gabe," she said, and he could tell from her voice that something was wrong. His eyes flicked across to look at the screen. Her face was fearful, and there were tears in her eyes.
"Baby, what's wrong?"
"You have to do what they say, Gabe," said Laura.
"Just do what they say."
"Baby, what are you talking about?" Red lights flashed ahead of him, and he realized the car ahead of him was braking. It was a black cab, slamming on the brakes to avoid a cyclist. The cab squealed to a halt, and Gabe only just managed to avoid smashing into the back of it. He looked back at the screen. Tears were running down his wife's face.
"Gabe, they say they'll kill me and Ollie if you don't do exactly as they say."
"Laura, what the hell's going on?"
"Please, Gabe, don't let them hurt Ollie."
"What do you mean? What the hell are you talking about?" The picture lurched, and Gabe realized Laura wasn't holding the phone. The phone pulled back, and he saw that Laura was sitting on a chair, her arms at her side. Then he saw the grey duct tape around her arms.
"Laura!" he shouted. "Gabe!"
The camera panned to the left, and Gabe caught a glimpse of a man wearing a ski mask. His stomach lurched. The taxi in front of him moved off.
"Laura, what's happening?"
he shouted, pulling the phone off its mount and holding it in front of him. The phone continued to pan to a sofa. Ollie was lying on it, bound with duct tape. There was a strip of tape across his son's mouth.
"Ollie, no!"
Horns began to sound impatiently behind him, but all his attention was on the screen. The phone moved closer in on Ollie, so close that Gabe could see the fear in the boy's tear-filled eyes.
"Ollie, don't worry. I'll get you out of there," he said.
The phone moved back, and Gabe saw there was another man in a ski mask standing behind the sofa holding a gun. His hands were trembling, but he managed to press the sleep button on the top of his phone and immediately hit the home button, capturing a screenshot of the image. He did it twice more. The horns behind him were more insistent now, with half a dozen cars joining in the cacophony. The phone tipped back down again, giving him a view of the duct tape around Ollie's arms and legs. More horns sounded, and Gabe pulled the car over to the side of the road and switched on his hazard lights. A white van drove by and the driver glared at him, flashed him a V-sign and mouthed obscenities. Gabe was already staring at the screen of his phone. The camera had panned back to Laura.
"We have your son and your wife," said a voice. "Now, listen carefully to what I have to say."
There was a view of the man standing near Laura, and Gabe took two more quick screenshots. Then another ski mask filled the screen.
"You are to make sure that your team loses today. Do you understand me?"
"What?" asked Gabe. "What the fuck are you talking about?"
"You will lose the match today. If your team wins, or if it is a draw, your family dies."
"I can't throw a whole game. I'm just one player," said Gabe.
"You can and you will," said the man. "But if you don't, your wife and son will die, and that will be on your head. And if you talk to the police, they will die. Tell no one. Just throw the match, and you'll get your family back, safe and sound."
"Why are you doing this?" asked Gabe.
"Do you understand?"
"Let me talk to my wife." The phone lurched, and Laura was on the screen.
"Gabe, please do what they say."
"Have they hurt you?"
"No, but they said they'll hurt Ollie if you don't do what they say."
Gabe heard something in a language he didn't recognize. Then the man standing next to Laura grabbed her by the hair and pulled her head back before pushing the barrel of his gun under her chin. Gabe saw a tattoo on the man's hand and he fumbled to get a screenshot.
"Please don't hurt her," he said.
"Do as we say, and we'll release her and your boy unharmed. All you have to do is make sure your team loses this afternoon. Do you understand?"
"Yes," said Gabe.
The man released his grip on Laura, and she slumped forward, sobbing. The man's ski mask filled the screen.
You lose the game. You don't contact the police. You don't tell anybody. Follow those three rules and you'll have your family back safe and sound.
The call ended and Gabe stared at the blank screen in disbelief. There was a loud knock on the passenger side window and Gabe flinched. It was a policeman.
You can't park here, said the officer. Red lines. Move on.
He was in his 20s and his helmet seemed a size too big for him. Gabe held up his phone.
I was just making a call.
You need to do that somewhere else, or I'm going to give you a ticket.
Sorry, said Gabe.
The policeman made a wind-the-window-down gesture with his hand, and Gabe did as he was told. The officer leaned forward, then his face broke into a smile.
You're Gabe Savage.
Yeah, said Gabe. Look, I'm sorry, I had to pull over to use the phone. I'll be on my way. Sorry about the inconvenience.
No problem, Gabe. Bloody hell, Gabe Savage. You got a big match today.
Gabe forced a smile.
I know.
Think you'll win? Asked the cop.
I hope so. You're the bookie's favourite.
That's what they say.
I was going to put a bet on, but the odds...
He shrugged.
And you got that record thing for the penalties?
Gabe nodded. He was finding it hard to concentrate on what the cop was saying. Images of a tearful Laura and Ollie, gagged and bound, kept filling his mind. The policeman was looking at him intently, and Gabe realised he had said something and was waiting for a reply.
Sorry, what? Said Gabe. I said, do you practice penalties a lot to get that good?
Pretty much every day, said Gabe.
The way you make that ball curve, oh, is something, said the cop.
He pointed at the road ahead. Anyway, you get on your way, Mr. Savage, and good luck today. He patted the car door and straightened up.
Thank you, officer, said Gabe.
The cop bobbed down again and gestured at the phone.
And don't hold that as you're driving. That'll get you a ticket, even if you're not actually using it.
Right, officer, thank you, said Gabe. He put the phone on the passenger seat and pulled away from the curb. His mind raced and he could barely concentrate on the traffic around him. He indicated left and pulled into a side street. He found a parking space and reversed into it, then grabbed the phone and stared at the screen. He called up the screenshots he'd taken and flicked through them, his heart pounding. He felt suddenly trapped by the car, and he got out and paced up and down the pavement. It was as if he was trapped in a nightmare, and if he could just force himself to wake up, everything would be all right, and he'd be lying in bed next to Laura. He took deep breaths, trying to calm himself down, but the screenshots of the men in ski masks just made it worse. A woman in a long coat walked by with a poodle on a lead. She looked at him inquisitively, and he turned away from her. He had to do something, but he had no idea what. Call the police? What could they do? And the warning had been clear. Talk to the police and Laura and Ollie would be killed. Could he throw a game? Maybe. Especially if there were any penalties. But what if he couldn't? What if he tried and the team still won? Laura and Ollie would be dead, and how would he be able to deal with it? He felt light-headed, and he realised he was hyperventilating. He tried to slow his breathing, but it was an effort. He wanted to run and scream and punch something. He folded his arms, gripping the phone tightly, his mind racing.
Fuck, 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 he repeated like a mantra. Fuck, 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 fuck.
He stopped swearing and leaned against a brick wall and began banging the back of his head against it. He needed help, but who? Who the hell could do anything to help him?
Chapter 17. Ray Savage had his game face on, jaw set tight, lips thin, eyes shielded behind impenetrable sunglasses. He was wearing a black Versace suit and a blue checked Ted Baker shirt, and in a holster under his right arm he had a fully loaded Glock pistol. He was standing with his back to the wall with his hands at his side. To his left was Mike Tyler. He was a few inches shorter than Ray and several kilos heavier. His suit wasn't quite as expensive, and he wasn't wearing sunglasses, but he had a matching Glock and a shoulder holster. Like Ray, he had his game face on, his lips tight and his eyes ever watchful. The two men were there to watch over their boss, Den Donovan, one of the country's major cannabis importers. Donovan spent most of his time in a palatial villa in the Caribbean, but whenever he was in the UK, he never went far without Mike or Ray. Today was special, a face-to-face meeting with the leader of a Yardie gang who controlled a large chunk of the crack cocaine market in Brixton.
No one knew what Wesley's other name was, or even if Wesley was his family name or his given name. Everyone called him Wesley, or Mad Wesley, if he was out of earshot. He was a big man, close to 7 feet, with short dreadlocks and a rash of tribal scars across both cheeks. He was wearing a denim shirt with cut-off sleeves that revealed bulging forearms and puckered skin close to his left shoulder, where a bullet had ripped through his flesh. There were another 3 similar wounds under the shirt, the result of an assassination attempt 3 years earlier. 2 men had between them put 4 bullets into Wesley, but he'd still managed to pull out his own gun and fight them off. He'd spent 2 weeks in intensive care, but within 3 months, both his attackers were dead and buried out in the New Forest. Wesley put his lucky escape down to the talisman that he always wore round his neck, but the emergency room doctors were of the opinion that it was his bulk that had saved him. Donovan had been the one who'd requested the meeting, so Wesley had insisted it be on his turf. They were in the back of a car wash he owned, a mainly cash business that he used to launder his illicit gains. They were in a storage room at the rear of the main cleaning area, and outside they could hear the splash of water and the slap of wet sponges against metal. It was a labour-intensive business, with most of the cleaning, inside and out, done by hand. There were no windows in the room, and it stank of detergent and stale water, but there was no chance of them being seen or overheard, so as far as Donovan was concerned, it was fit for purpose. Donovan and Wesley were sitting either side of a wooden table covered with empty bottles and ashtrays overflowing with the butts of cannabis cigarettes. Whereas Wesley ran his drugs operation with a steel hand, he was clearly much more relaxed about what his car cleaners did in their downtime. Everyone in the room was armed. There were 2 ways to arrange a meeting. One was to insist on no weapons, but that was always difficult to enforce, as it meant searching everyone, and there was always at least 1 person who took offence. Having everyone unarmed also left them vulnerable to a surprise attack, so no one was happy about giving up their weapons. Ray preferred the second option. Weapons were just fine, so long as they stayed concealed. Everyone then just assumed that everyone else was armed and behaved accordingly. There were 8 men in the room, the principals and 3 heavies each. That had been agreed in advance. The 3rd member of Donovan's security detail was Barry Chisnell. He was only in his 20s, but he was a former squaddy and as hard as nails. He was standing on one side of the door, his arms at his side. On the other side of the door was one of Wesley's heavies, a lanky Rastafarian with waist-length dreadlocks tied back with a knotted yellow, green and red handkerchief. Wesley's 2 other heavies were standing by the wall facing Ray and Mike. The 3 yardies who were looking after Wesley hadn't bothered with holsters. Their guns were tucked into their belts, which in Ray's opinion showed a distinct lack of professionalism. Belts could easily snag a weapon. Pulling a gun from a holster was always smoother and faster. Donovan wasn't a big fan of face-to-face meetings, but Wesley had insisted and made it a deal-breaker. Donovan had decided that since there were no drugs and no money involved, the sit-down was probably worth the risk.
"Thanks for seeing me, Wesley," said Donovan. "I know you by reputation, obviously."
Wesley nodded, accepting the compliment.
"We've got a problem with the Turks, and I gather you're having problems too." "What makes you say that?" asked Wesley. "It's no secret that 3 of your people have been shot in the past couple of months. The boys at Operation Trident put it down as black on black, but we both know it's the Turks. They're encroaching on your turf, and you can't have that, right?"
Wesley nodded slowly.
"Go on." "We're in the same boat," said Donovan. "Last month, a consignment of mine was hijacked on the way from the docks to London. 2 of my men were put in hospital, and I lost 0.5 ton of very high-grade cannabis. It came out of the blue, and I had no inkling of who might have done it. And suddenly, Stoke Newington and 1/2 of North London is awash with the stuff, so much of it that the price dropped by 1/3.
"The Turks only deal heroin," said Wesley. "Protection rackets and prostitution among their own communities. But outside of that, their only interest is heroin."
"In the past, that's true," said Donovan, "which is why they've never been a problem in the past. I bring in my bit of puff, you handle the crack and the coke, the Turks import their heroin, everyone makes money. But that's all gone to fuck now that the EU has gone and allowed 70 million Turks visa-free access to Europe. Their criminals are flooding into Europe, and a lot of them are getting across the channel now.
The heroin trade alone isn't enough to keep them all occupied, so they're starting to spread their wings.
Wesley's brow creased into a deep frown.
And you know this how?
Because I got my ear to the ground, mate, he said. It's happening right across the country. Same as when Yugoslavia fell apart in the 90s and all the Bosnian and Serbian mafia flooded in.
Wesley grinned, showing a single gold tooth at the front of his mouth.
Before my time, he said.
Mine too, said Donovan. I was just pointing out the historical precedent. It happened when communism folded in Russia and we had all the Russian gangsters piling in. Now it's the Turks. There were just too many of them to stay confined to the heroin trade, and that means they're going to start treading on our toes.
Ray's phone rang, and both men looked over at him. The James Bond theme. Ray was a big fan of the Bond movies, especially the Daniel Craig ones, because the general view was that Ray was the spitting image of the actor, albeit a few kilos heavier. Donovan shook his head angrily.
Are you fucking serious, Ray?
Sorry, thought I'd put it on silent.
Yeah, well, you clearly didn't, said Donovan. He looked over at Wesley.
Sorry that my associate is such an arsehole.
Wesley shrugged.
It's okay, so long as it's not the cops calling.
See now, that's not funny, said Donovan.
The theme tune continued to ring out.
Fucking hell, Ray, will you deal with that?
Ray reached for his phone, but as he did, the two yardies opposite pulled out their guns and aimed them at him gangster style, the butts parallel to the floor. Ray raised his hands.
Guys, he said, it's a phone.
He pointed at his left armpit with his right hand.
This is where my gun is.
He pointed at his right jacket pocket.
This is where my phone is. Now, I'm going to take it out slowly, and you'll see it's a bloody iPhone, and not a Heckler and Koch, okay?
One of the yardies waved his gun at Ray's chest, his finger on the trigger.
Let's see it, man. For fuck's sake, how many guns do you know that play the James Bond theme? Asked Ray.
Mike pulled out his gun and aimed it at the yardie who was threatening Ray.
Put the fucking gun away, he said.
The second yardie took a step towards Mike and aimed his gun at Mike's face.
You drop your gun first, he shouted.
The third yardie pulled his gun from his belt and waved it around as if unsure who he should be pointing it at. Then Barry produced his Glock and aimed it at him, his face impassive. Wesley stood up slowly and pulled out his gun, a large chromed automatic with a mother-of-pearl handle. He pointed the gun at Donovan.
What the fuck's going on, man? He shouted.
Donovan smiled and raised his hands.
For fuck's sake, Wesley, will you fucking chill out?
He looked over at Ray.
See what you fucking started here?
Ray sighed and raised both his hands high up above his head.
Guys, look, I'm sorry, okay? He shouted. My fucking bad. I'm an arsehole for not switching my phone off, but what's done is done. It's a fucking phone. It's an iPhone 5, for fuck's sake. It's not even a 6 or a 7. So let me take it out and switch it off, and we can carry on with business, okay?
He kept his left hand above his head as he reached down slowly with his right hand to fish out the still ringing phone. Wesley relaxed slightly, but still kept his gun pointed at Donovan.
Are you fucking happy now, Wesley? Asked Donovan. It's a phone, for fuck's sake. Put your pea shooter away. Who the fuck is it? Asked Wesley. What the fuck does that matter?
Donovan pointed his finger at Ray.
Turn that fucking thing off, Ray, or I swear I'll shove it so far up your ass that you'll be burping text messages.
Ray stared at the screen, frowning.
Ray, turn that fucking thing off now, growled Donovan, or I swear to God I'll shoot you myself.
Ray turned his back on Donovan and took the call.
What? He said.
Ray?
You dialed my number by mistake, did you? Are you in London? Asked Gabe. You don't talk to me for, what, 10 years, and now you want to know where I am?
Donovan stood up, pulled out a Glock, and gestured at Ray with it.
For fuck's sake, Ray, we're in the middle of something here if you ain't noticed. Put the fucking phone away!
Ray waved him away without turning around.
You got a fucking cheek, Gabe. I need your help, Ray.
What? It was the last thing Ray expected to hear.
I need your help. It's Laura.
She's been kidnapped. And Ollie. I'm in deep shit, Ray. I didn't know who else to call. What the fuck?
Donovan walked over and put his left hand on Ray's shoulder, but Ray shook him off.
Ray, what the fuck are you playing at?
Snapped Donovan. Ray turned to glare at him.
It's Gabe. He's in trouble.
Donovan frowned.
I thought him and you never spoke. We don't. He wants fuck all to do with me. But he needs my help. It's serious. I've got to go. Sorry.
Donovan stared at him for several seconds, and then he nodded.
Okay, fuck off. Will somebody tell me what the fuck's going on? Shouted Wesley. Are we doing this fucking deal or not?
Ray's got to go, said Donovan. Ray started walking towards the door. Wesley pointed his gun at Ray's back.
You ain't going anywhere, he shouted.
Leave him be, said Donovan. He's got family troubles.
Family troubles? What the fuck? Just let him go. How do I know he's not going to get the cops?
Donovan laughed harshly.
Ray Savage, talking to the cops. Give me a fucking break, Wesley.
Ray reached the door, pulled it open, and left the building. Donovan put his gun into his holster and raised his hands.
Look, Wesley, all's good. Ray's just got some personal business to take care of. We're all good.
Wesley jutted up his chin, then nodded slowly.
Yeah, okay.
He put his own gun away and nodded at his team to do the same. Mike was the last to lower his gun and slide it into his holster. Wesley gestured at the door.
Families always fuck you over, one way or another.
That's true, said Donovan.
I was asking for money or help or whatever. Mine drive me fucking crazy. 3 wives, 8 kids. I should learn to keep my dick in my pants, right?
Wesley sat down and sighed.
Okay, let's get down to business. How the fuck are we going to handle the Turks?
Chapter 18. Ray walked away from the car wash, his phone clamped to his ear.
What the fuck's going on, Gabe?
Laura's been kidnapped. If I don't throw this afternoon's game, they'll kill her, and Ollie.
Who'll kill her?
I don't know.
You don't know? How can you not know?
All I got was a call from Laura. She was with some guys in ski masks. They said we had to lose. If we don't lose, they'll kill her, and Ollie.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Where are you?
I'm heading to the training ground to get on the team bus. The match starts at 3.
Have you called the cops?
No. Do you think I should?
Nah, mate. The cops would only fuck it up.
He stopped walking.
Look, Gabe, you sure it's not a con? Have you tried calling her?
It goes straight through to voicemail, and there's no answer on the home phone. Ray, what do I do? I'm at my wit's end here.
Just stay calm, Gabe. I'll find her. Where was she last time you saw her?
At home, this morning. They were coming to the match later.
Ray started walking again. His BMW was parked next to the black Range Rover that Donovan, Mike and Barry had arrived in.
And you've no idea who they might be?
Of course not.
You haven't been dealing with any shady characters.
What the fuck are you talking about?
Ray took his key fob from his pocket and clicked it.
Don't snap my head off, Gabe. I'm just asking. Maybe it's someone you know. Someone you've crossed paths with.
You think someone I know has done this?
That's what I'm asking you.
I'm not in bed with match fixers, if that's what you mean.
Ray pulled open the car door and climbed in.
What about the guys in the ski masks?
What do you mean?
What can you tell me about them?
Hell, I don't know.
What did they look like?
Are you not fucking listening? They were wearing ski masks.
I heard you. But were they white, black, Asian?
Not black, white, maybe. I don't know, Ray.
Big, small, short, tall?
Difficult to say.
Taller than Laura. Shorter.
She was in a chair. They were standing over her.
There was a silence of a couple of seconds.
Yeah, they weren't tall, and they didn't look big. Not that big, anyway. Average.
Anything else? Anything you can remember?
They had guns.
Okay. But what about the men?
I keep telling you, Ray, they were wearing fucking ski masks.
Clothes, Gabe. Jewellery, watches, anything that might help identify them.
He started the engine.
I took screenshots, said Gabe.
You what?
Screenshots, while they were talking.
Why the fuck didn't you say so? Send them to my phone.
I will do. Ray, what are you going to do?
I'm going to check your house, just to make sure they're not there and that someone's not pulling your chain.
This isn't a fucking prank, Ray. Do you want the address?
I know where you live, Gabe. Don't worry, I'll get this sorted one way or another.
Ray ended the call, tossed the phone onto the passenger seat and drove out of the car park. 2 minutes later, his phone beeped to say that he'd received a text message, then another and another. Ray ignored them and concentrated on cutting through the Saturday morning traffic. Chapter 19. Gabe drove into the training ground. From the number of luxury cars in the car park, it looked as if he was the last to arrive. He hurried into the changing rooms. Tommy Brett pointed at the wall clock. It was 10:15.
I'm going to have to find you, Gabe, said the assistant coach. You know the rules.
I was checking on Eric for Joe, said Gabe, tossing his kit bag down in front of his locker.
He didn't tell me, sorry, said Brett.
Gabe's training kit was hanging up inside his locker, freshly laundered. He kicked off his shoes, then took off his suit and hung it up.
So, what's the story with Eric? Asked Brett.
He wasn't home, but his car was there, said Gabe, taking off his tie and shirt.
Do you think he's drinking again?
I don't know, Tommy. He's been off the booze for months.
Either that or he got good at hiding it, said Brett. He's gone off the rails before.
That was 2-3 years ago, said Gabe.
Leopards don't change their spots, said Brett.
Once a drunk, always a drunk. Is that what you're saying?
If the cap fits, said Brett. I'm just saying, it's not the first time he's fucked up.
Okay, see you on the pitch.
He jogged off before Gabe could say anything.
Gabe finished changing, grabbed himself a bottle of water and headed out.
The training sessions on match day were always a relaxed affair, an hour and a half of warming up and rehearsing a few set pieces. Joe McNamara was running things, wearing a dark blue tracksuit and with his whistle on a club lanyard. He waved at Gabe when he saw him and jogged over.
You okay? Asked the coach.
Sure.
Still no sign of Eric.
Gabe shook his head. Did you check the hospitals?
I got Tommy to call around, but getting information from the NHS is like getting blood from a stone. So, if he is in a hospital somewhere, we're none the wiser. I'm thinking of calling the cops, see if they can get anywhere.
Gabe's stomach lurched at the mention of the police. If he was seen speaking to the police, the kidnappers might think he'd called them in.
Wouldn't be great publicity for the club, said Gabe. You know the cops always talk to the press. Gattuso will hit the roof if he read about it in the papers.
McNamara swore.
Yeah, you're probably right. He looked at his watch. I suppose there's still a chance he'll turn up.
He patted Gabe on the back.
Okay, let's get you warmed up.
He blew a sharp blast on his whistle to attract the attention of the squad.
Right, guys, just want to let you know that we're having problems locating Eric LeBrun. So, in his absence, Gabe here will be acting captain, shouted the coach. Gabe here didn't ask for the job. He's had it thrust upon him, as it were. So, give him your best and don't give him any grief.
What's happened to Eric? Asked Devereux.
He's not available, said McNamara. That's all we know.
He pointed over at Johnny Reed, a young midfielder who joined the squad from Newcastle 6 months earlier, but had yet to play for the first team.
Johnny'll take Eric's place in midfield.
So, Eric's been dropped? Asked Stefano Amati, an Italian player with movie-star looks and a seven-figure contract to be one of the faces of Hugo Boss.
He's not been dropped, Stefano. We're just not sure where he is.
He clapped his hands together.
Right, come on, let's get moving. Those highly paid muscles won't warm themselves up.
Chapter 20. There was a red Honda CRV parked in front of Gabe's house, and Ray parked behind it. He ran up to the front door and pressed the bell, long and hard, then shouted through the letterbox. There was no reply, and he hurried around to the rear garden. The kitchen door was locked, and so was the sliding door into the conservatory. Ray picked up a rock and weighed it in his hand. Gabe's house was fitted with an alarm system, but if Laura and Ollie had been kidnapped, the kidnappers were unlikely to have set the alarm when they left. He threw the rock with all his strength at one of the conservatory windows, and it shattered.
Ray pulled out the remaining shards and then stepped through into the conservatory. He moved quickly through the ground floor. There were breakfast things on the table in the kitchen, but no signs of violence or a struggle. There was a fashion magazine open on a coffee table and an open Chanel handbag on one of the sofas. Ray picked it up. Inside was a purse, makeup and keys. He doubted that Laura had left the house voluntarily without taking her keys with her. There was a selection of framed family photographs on a low sideboard, mainly of Gabe, Laura and Ollie, including several when Ollie was a babe in arms. There was a large photograph of Laura and Gabe's wedding, with the bride and groom surrounded by friends and family. Ray wasn't in the photograph. He hadn't been invited, and had only found out about it 3 months after the event. Gabe had been playing for Oldham Athletic, and his agent had just started negotiations with Liverpool. Laura had been 5 months pregnant at the wedding, but there was barely a bulge to be seen. Gabe and Ray's parents were there, as proud as punch, and Ray had never forgiven them for not telling him about the wedding. Ray shook his head sadly as he stared at the photograph. He didn't blame Gabe for cutting him out of his life. He'd probably have done the same if the roles had been reversed. He went upstairs and checked the bedrooms and bathrooms, although he knew he wasn't going to find anything. Ollie's bedroom was a mess, the quilt half off the bed, and clothes thrown around the floor. But Ray was sure that was just the result of general untidiness rather than signs of an abduction. The master bedroom was the opposite. The bed had been neatly made, and there were half a dozen cushions arranged perfectly against the headboard. The bathroom was spotless, with gleaming marble his and her sinks. On the side that was obviously Laura's was a row of perfume bottles. One of them was Chanel Coco. Ray recognised the black bottle. He picked it up and squirted it onto the back of his hand, then sniffed it and smiled. He replaced the bottle, went back into the bedroom, sat down on the bed and took out his phone. There were 6 messages from Gabe, each a screenshot. He flicked through them. There were 3 men in the pictures, all wearing ski masks. One of the pictures showed the hand of one of the men. Ray zoomed in on the hand. There was a tattoo between the thumb and the first finger, a scorpion, and what looked like a Chinese character. He went through the screenshots again, slowly this time. He zoomed into the faces. The eyes could be Chinese, it was hard to tell. One of the men sported a green ring, jade maybe. Another indication that the kidnappers might be Chinese. It made sense. The kidnappers wanted Gabe to throw the game, and the Chinese bet millions on UK football matches. He called Gabe's number and it went through to voicemail.
Gabe, mate, I'm at the house. I've got the pictures. I'm thinking they're Chinese. I know someone in Chinatown who might help us ID these bastards. Chin up, mate, I'm on it. You play your game, I'll play mine.
He ended the call and stood up, taking a quick look at his watch as he headed downstairs. It was just coming up to 11, just 4 hours to go before kick-off. Chapter 21 McNamara had the squad jog slowly around one of the pitches just to loosen up, then started them on a few passing exercises. It was all gentle stuff. The coach didn't want any pulled muscles or stupid injuries. The pre-match training was more about building team spirit than anything. Some managers allowed their teams to arrive at the ground on match day, get changed and play, but Piero Gattuso insisted that they meet first at the training ground and travel together to the stadium. He also insisted that players didn't use phones or headphones on the coach. He wanted them socialising and talking so that when they ran out onto the pitch, they were a true team and not a group of highly paid individuals. Despite there being more than a dozen nationalities on the squad, Gattuso insisted that everyone spoke English. He followed his own rules. There were 3 Italians on the Walford United team, Luca Moretti, Stefano Amati, and Marco Mancini, and whenever he spoke to them, he did so in English. Being caught speaking any other language than English was an automatic £200 fine. Gattuso rarely attended the training ground himself. He believed in letting his coaching staff do their jobs and judge them by their results, rather than micromanaging them. So far, his faith in the coaches had paid off, and the team were 3rd in the Premier League, with the bookies giving even odds of them being on top by the end of the season, now just 2 months away. After half an hour of warming up, McNamara split the squad up into groups of 5, and they put on coloured vests. Gabe was teamed up with Watts, Mancini, Wood and Babacar, the green team. "Let's have a few quick games," said McNamara. Green against blue, red against yellow. Blue team consisted of Reed, Tim Mapplethorpe, Devereaux, and two of the reserves.
Tenner says we trounce you, said Devereaux.
I'll take that bet, said Wood. McNamara blew his whistle. Don't even joke about gambling on games, he shouted. You know the boss will have you off the squad for that.
Right, blues and greens on pitch A, yellow and red on pitch B with Tommy, and take it easy. No pushing, no shoving, no silly tackles. And I want to see you all creating space. Chelsea are going to keep you all on tight leashes.
Wood started to howl like a wolf, and the squad laughed.
Very funny, Jason, said McNamara. Let's see if you're still laughing at 3 o'clock.
He blew his whistle again. Come on, let's get started. Gabe looked over at the changing rooms. More than anything, he wanted to call Ray to find out what was happening. McNamara blew his whistle again.
Come on, Gabe, shouted the coach. Look lively.
Gabe waved in acknowledgement and jogged over to join the rest of the green team on pitch A, though football was the last thing on his mind. All he could think about was how terrified Laura and Ollie must be and how powerless he was to do anything to help.